The Linux Link Tech Show is proudly sponsored by Open Country, providers of OCM, award-winning systems management software for the Linux Enterprise, and exclusive sponsors of the Webmin Project.
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show! Tech Show! Tech Show! Yeah!
The Linux Link Tech Show is on.
Is on.
Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Free software, free speech, open technology,
and open mind.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
And there you go, fellas.
Another exciting episode
of Netcasts you love, you hate,
all the way.
People you don't trust, right?
For bullshit from the people you hate. All the way from Norway, we've got Zach Russin from the KDE Project.
I guess.
How is it? How's it going? How are you, Zach?
Not bad, not bad. How are you
going? To go to there.
So what the heck is going on in Norway, man?
There's a lot, actually. It really depends what kind of a discussion are we going for. Are we going for high-level or low-level discussion? Because we can take it both ways.
Well, our listeners love it always.
So. Get hardcore.
Yeah.
All right, so let's start at the low level, meaning the driver development and the X itself. Last year, an X development has been really, really exciting. First of all, right, the whole thing with X is that it's been stale for so many years. So right now, seeing all the development that we are seeing in X, it's incredible. It's really, really exciting. And the thing that makes it so special is that we keep getting more and more developers who are trying to get on the wave. So we have more and more developers working on more new features and more new functionality. And all of that is expanding into a lot bigger project than it used to be. So we're seeing a lot more rapid changes than we used to in the last few years. Just yesterday, someone actually announced that the multi-pointer X project is nearing completion, meaning we're going to be able to support multiple input devices on X, or you're going to be able to have multiple cursors at the same time on the screen, which is development that I was eagerly waiting for. Right, a lot of graphics artists wants to have multiple pointers on X, so it's really nice to see people actually working on those features. Then you get an announcement like the one from Intel, right, where they mentioned that they will be working on drivers in a fully open source fashion. Up till recently, right, it was Tungsten Graphics that had contract with Intel to work on drivers. Now Intel has the team themselves, right, it's Keith and Eric working on those drivers internally. And it's really exciting. The things they were doing with the Intel driver are pretty special, from texture video support, which is very, very important for a very simple reason. Up till recently, the way video was handled in X was using special chip inside your graphics card, which is the backend scaler. Backend scalers have been historically really good at doing full screen video playback because they have very trivial functionality that is required to set up brightness and to do color conversion. It's a very specialized chip used only for video playback. Unfortunately, the side effect of using backend scaler is the fact that you do not have access to the colors that are actually transmitted to the frame buffer. So what you get is the color in which the video is transposed on, which is usually blue, which is by one of the main reason why if you took a screenshot of a movie playing on your Linux desktop, you would get this blue window in the middle of your screen. So what Intel guys did, they decided that instead of using backend scalers, they would use texture memory units, which are available on all recent video hardware. And it's basically the device that the part of your graphics card that is responsible for composing textures. So they use actually TMUs to create video playback, and they use small fragment shading programs to do color conversion. And it works beautifully, and the thing that is really great about it is that it integrates with the concept of a composited desktop. So you do have access to the video. So when you take a screenshot of your composed desktop, you actually do get the screenshot with the video playing inside. So you don't get any more the color opacity that you usually get for drivers that support only backend scalers. So that was one thing they did that was very exciting. Plus, they're going away from using fixed pipeline. What was happening for the last few years is that we used to use fixed pipeline in pretty much all our drivers. Fixed pipeline meaning the functionality was not programmable by us, but it was going through the whole hardware stack. Right now, Intel guys are going for writing small fragment shading programs that are actually responsible for doing a lot of those little things that fixed pipeline was scheduled to do. It gives us a lot more flexibility when it comes to the drivers, and it's actually a lot easier and it looks a lot nicer. So you have those small programs that handle color conversion, that handle special things within the acceleration architecture, and it works beautifully. So I was really happy to see that. Plus, right now, they work in a lot of different branches, right, because they have one of the things that Keith was bragging about lately on pretty much all the conferences was support for hot pluggable monitors. So you can go with your laptop on a conference session, actually connect your laptop, and see it projected correctly on the screen without having to be rebooting X, which used to be very embarrassing, right? If you're in a professional environment, then you're going for professional presentation, and then you hook up your laptop, and you have to reboot it to actually connect anything. It just doesn't look great. Right now, we have support for that. And the Keith did a lot of work on both the R&R specification to actually enable hot pluggable devices and screens on your Linux desktop. And they did a lot of work within the Intel drivers to actually support it. I think we're going to see more and more drivers switching to the new R&R protocol spec. Someone started working on ATI driver to actually support that. And it's very, very exciting because ATI driver is probably the one I'm most afraid of right now because, NVIDIA and Intel, they both work on drivers internally, and they do support Linux to a great, great extent. ATI is a little different in the sense that their driver is nowhere near as complete as the drivers from Intel and NVIDIA. And you don't have a lot of people who are familiar with the code. Plus, the code is really messy. We have one of the bad things that we did, we split up the driver. You have different set of drivers for different ATI chips. And that architecture is not great because what happens is that a lot of code is shared between all those drivers, but it's shared by copying. So if you have a bug in the code that is shared between all those drivers, you have to fix it in three places. People usually forget to do that because when they work with a graphics chip, they usually work with only one. So when they fix a bug, they never integrate into the other drivers. So the drivers share a lot of the code, and they share a lot of the bugs. A lot of the drivers have fixes that are not integrated into the other drivers. So they have unique bugs, and it's really messy. And it's hard to find people who are willing to actually reverse engineer graphics hardware because it is insanely difficult. And it's not something that people would be willing to do in their free time, spare time, unless you're someone like Dave Early, who's absolutely crazy, and I love the guy because the things he's doing are just incredible. He's one of the best reverse engineers I've ever seen, and we're so happy to have him actually on board. He's right now technically the maintainer for ATI. He would probably say that he's not, and he mentions that in every single release of the ATI drivers, he's responsible for doing the releases. And he keeps mentioning that he's not the maintainer, he just happens to be doing the releases. But the matter of the fact is that he's doing a lot of work on those drivers, and he's probably the only person who would be capable of reverse engineering the modeling setting chip that is in the new R500 series. ATI changed the mold line setting chip in the recent hardware. They took basically the device they use in their HDTV setups, and they replaced it in their graphics chips, in their graphics cards. Unfortunately for us, we have no idea how those things work, which is why for the longest time, all the 1600 series of ATI cards didn't work on Linux at all. You would have to use a VESA driver to get any kind of an output. It looks better right now, but if you look even at the commercial drivers that they release for Linux, they haven't been supporting 1600 series for a long, long time. And it's probably the fact that they just don't have right now a Linux team working in full on those drivers. So that is the driver that is worrying them most. And they've actually started working on supporting RNR 2.0 in the ATI driver, which is excellent because you see more and more laptops coming out with ATI chips. It seems like ATI right now has a more of a market for laptop chips than NVIDIA does. So we definitely want to have support for RNR in the ATI driver. It's just the question of who would have the kind of a time and persistence to actually implement that, and hopefully Dave is the one to do it. Right now, if you're going for hardware that is well supported under Linux, you would have to go for Intel just because they do work on those drivers in the open. Not to say that the NVIDIA drivers don't work well, they do. But it's really nice to have that option of seeing the code if you're a developer, and if you're not a developer, of actually reporting the bugs to the Xorg list and seeing people respond in a meaningful way. So that workflow where everything that you do is available in the open is actually very helpful to the community. You as a user can come up to any of the lists and see people who are either working on the driver currently or have vast knowledge of it and get meaningful responses everywhere. Plus, as an open source developer, I'm inclined to be more favorable towards companies that actually do work in the open, like Intel is doing right now.
Can I just got a new laptop, actually.
Go ahead, Pat.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you know, when something's out in the open, people will learn how it works, and you'll just have more people who understand the inner workings of how to code it and do development for it, where, you know, if you always have to reverse engineer everything, it's kind of like, you know, the secret sauce magic, you know. No one's going to really know how to do it.
Yeah. It's actually insanely difficult to reverse engineer those things. One thing I still haven't seen any of the companies doing is releasing OpenSpec. The fact that the Intel drivers work in the open is wonderful. It's really great. But it doesn't change the fact that for new developers, it's still very difficult to figure out what exactly is happening because you have to have a great understanding of the source code to actually figure that setting those registers who are named this and that is actually doing this and that. You would love to have open specification for hardware that actually tells you what is happening, what is supposed to be happening. And probably the most important thing is every single hardware has issues. There's a lot of bugs in the hardware, and there are internal documents usually that mention what is not working the way it's supposed to be. You have tight schedules on hardware, so when something doesn't work, usually document it, send it to developers, and are done with it, right? You don't want to postpone your release date because there's some problem with sending this register to that function, and it doesn't work the way it was supposed to. So you just document that and send it off. We don't have access to those documents. So when you work on drivers and something doesn't work, you're pretty much left in the blank, right? You're trying to figure out whether it's a bug in the hardware or if it's a bug in your code. And it tends to be very problematic. So that's one thing I'm still waiting for. I heard rumors that ATI is actually looking into open sourcing specs for some of the hardware. The thing I heard from a lot of companies producing graphics hardware right now is that it's insanely difficult to change a policy within a large company, meaning it's almost impossible to release specs for hardware that has been already released because the whole marketing strategy and the whole release policy for that particular hardware has been already set. So changing policy for release hardware is insanely difficult within large companies. So what people are trying to do, like says at Intel, right, they're trying to enforce new policies on hardware that is going to be released. Meaning it's easier to change policy for stuff that is about to be released than it is for stuff that has been released. So I'm not sure whether ATI will be able to actually pull this one off. It would be an incredible feat and very, very helpful for all the developers. And I'm sure we would get a lot more people working on ATI drivers if you would have specs for that hardware. it would help us tremendously. Not having to reverse engineer hardware and struggle with all those bugs, like I mentioned before, would be a tremendous help to all of us. So I'm waiting for that announcement like I am for food in the United States at this point right now. It's very, very important for us to get those specifications. While for Intel and NVIDIA, it's a little different, right, because those companies actually actively support their drivers. For ATI, we would need some kind of a help right now. There's not enough people who are capable and willing of working on those graphics drivers. And spending time reverse engineering is basically just wasting your time instead of being able to code directly. So I'm in dire need of those specifications right now, and hopefully ATI will be able to pull it off.
Zach, you work for Trailtech, right?
Yes, I do.
Now, you really seem to have a pulse on what's going on with X and all the issues with the graphics cards. What exactly do you do for Trailtech?
I do graphics. My official position actually at the company is a graphics ninja. And there's a weird story behind that, because all the developers at Trailtech get business cards, right, which is a pretty common practice nowadays. And I got a call from our secretary, which is handling all of this. And she asked me what is my position at Trailtech, and I was actually working on graphics issues within Qt, and I actually managed to squeeze out some more performance out of it a second before she gave me a call. So I picked up the phone, and she asked me what is my position, and being really excited about the fact that I actually fixed a really nasty bug and improved performance, I said, I'm a freaking graphics ninja. And she said, okay, thank you, and disconnected. And for a while, I couldn't figure out what the hell did she want that for. And then next day, Matthias Etrich, who was at the time my manager, came in and said, we did those business cards the way you wanted them. And I said, a what? And he said, well, we did that what you wanted. And he pointed me to my new business cards with said Graphics Ninja. So my official position at the company, which was created just because I'm silly, was a graphics ninja. And yeah, I handle everything that deals with graphics, meaning the whole stack. If there's a bug coming in saying there's something happening on this and this hardware, but this and this version of X, on this and this version of Qt, I look at it and I fix it, right? If it's either in the device driver code, X, Qt, anywhere within that stack, I just go and fix it. So I handle graphics from SVG through low-level stuff.
Now, Lubos Lunik, who was working on Kwin Composite, he had mentioned some of the development that was going on with that. It sounds pretty promising, and it almost sounds like it's going to compete with Compiz and Barrel.
Yeah, I'm not sure how happy I am about having another composition manager. It's something that Lubos has been complaining to me a lot about, and it's just the fact that I really don't have time to be working on a composition manager. The thing is, both Barrel and Compiz has one tremendous tremendous problem, and that is the fact that they only work with X servers that actually support OpenGL in a pretty advanced manner. You don't have that luxury on a lot of the setups that we have right now, so you need to have some kind of a fallback. For KD4, we're trying to figure out whether it's worth having a composition manager that is capable of adjusting to both those environments, meaning fully OpenGL accelerated environment and environment where you don't get OpenGL acceleration. I'm still torn between whether we should do it or not, meaning support non-OpenGL environments. Personally, I think that if you really want you're looking at facts, you're looking for something that does have OpenGL support. And if not, then big chances you're looking at a system whose owner is not really interested in eye candy anyway. Those are probably production systems or old laptops where people really are not going to be running or needing those kinds of effects. So you just need reasonable fallbacks for that. I think the work Lubos is doing is tremendous, and it might be very helpful, but whether Kwin is a better solution for KD4 than using Compiz and just straight up Kwin for places where you don't get composition at all, that's another issue. the thing is it's not only coding those features, it's maintaining them. That is the headache. Right? I could write a composition manager in about 2 days. It's a question of what's going to happen with it after I'm done with it. It's something people have been complaining about a lot of the things I do, right? Because I tend to write a lot of code, but I don't have time to maintain 90% of it, and the code just dies. So it's a question of whether KDE is capable of developing and maintaining their own composition manager as well as they would be if composition manager could be shared between all of the desktops like it would be when it comes to Beryl or Compass.
It sounds like a lot more effort is required to do it. I mean, you know, we're duplicating
it's like
our efforts.
Pretty much every single thing on Linux desktop that is handling some complex feature. And composition managers are very similar to window managers in the sense that it's trivial to get something that does something. And it's insanely difficult to write something that does everything. So it's trivial to write prototype. It's insanely difficult to write something that is stable, that is working well within all kinds of configurations and desktops that we have right now. That is a big problem. The problem is never getting something into unstable form. That is always trivial, and that is always a lot of fun because you're working with new code and you're learning and it's exciting. But then it comes to stabilizing that thing and actually making it work in a usable fashion. And that work usually sucks, right? Because it's boring. It's boring and you're solving problems that you usually don't see in your development setup. Because when you work on this code, you make sure it works on your machine and your machine only. And then you get reports about stuff that you wrote not working in this configuration and that configuration. And then you go over your code and try to figure out those arbitrary problems within the code base. It's just really, really boring. And the question is whether Lubos has enough persistence to actually do it and whether we have enough graphics artists to actually create those effects that are within Compass and Beryl. The problem is I thought about doing that for a while. It's just sharing the plugins, right? Because Beryl and Compass use plugins for most of their effects. And it's a question of whether we're capable of sharing those plugins. The problem is that both Beryl and Compass are C-based code bases. So plugins export pretty much every functionality you could possibly imagine. The whole core of Compass and Beryl is exposed to plugins. And that is the kind of abstraction that is really hard to achieve with C++. You would basically need a structure that gives access to everything within the window manager. Lubos has been reluctant to do that for obvious reasons. You don't want to have you don't want to give plugins complete control over window manager functionality. And it makes a lot of sense, right? It just doesn't sound like a great security feature. Plus, the kind of things that Compass and Beryl expose are really difficult to achieve within the current K1 framework. So I think sharing plugins would be basically impossible. Sharing some of the code, yeah, definitely, of course, you can do that, but it's a question of how much you can share and where you would put the common code. Right now, there is really no way because the graphics code is obviously specific to plugins on both Compass and Beryl. So you can just take that code and use it within K1. It just wouldn't work. Plus, it would create the same kind of silly relationship that all the ATI drivers share, meaning you would have shared code that is shared by copying. Right? So you have a lot of places that share the same bugs, and then if one of them would get fixes, the functionality would suddenly become very consistent. You would get some bugs on some setups and no bugs on others. So I don't know. I think it makes sense to have a fallback for systems that don't support OpenGL. Whether that fallback should be a whole new composition manager is I don't know, I'm not sure. I think it makes sense for systems that actually don't support OpenGL but would support EXA. But I haven't seen such systems yet. When I ported EXA from KDrive to XOR, I always anticipated that this architecture will be used by devices that actually don't have full OpenGL support, meaning they support a lot of 2D acceleration from simple blitting to just going simple primitives and doing some kind of per-def composition. But I haven't seen that yet. So I'm not sure if it's going to happen. And coding for stuff that might happen is never a great idea. It's something that actually goes against KDE. A lot of the things that KDE has been doing was making sure things work correctly right now. There hasn't been any virtual component to the setup of the whole environment when it came to KDE. We're always trying to solve problems that were appearing on a consistent basis on desktops right now. That was the whole issue with Decup, right? That's how Decup started. We just said we need something that works, and Corba just doesn't cut it. So let's solve that problem, and we solved it in the simplest possible way. Decup was the simple solution that solved a very trivial problem. So whether solving that trivial, technically, problem, right, because the it's trivially detectable whether a desktop has OpenGL support or not. That is trivial. Whether solving a trivial problem requires a complex solution like a whole new composition manager is debatable. To me, it doesn't. Lubos thinks it makes sense. One thing that definitely does make sense is keeping the window management code that is in KWin. Lubos did a lot of work on focus stealing prevention mechanism, and a lot of the code paths in KWin are dedicated to that, and there's immense amount of work that went to fixing bugs with applications that try to manage themselves, like XMMS and a lot of the older applications, and a lot of the proprietary Unix applications that were supposed to work on it. So all those fixes are in KWin, and now trying to implement all of that window management functionality in Compass and Barrel is going to be basically just as painful. Which is one of the reasons why you see a lot of developers saying that both Compass and Barrel are pretty much toy projects, because they don't handle those corner cases of window management. So I personally think it would be easier to implement that window management functionality in a fully-fledged composition manager than implement a fully-fledged composition manager in a window manager. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe people will prove me wrong. Hopefully, actually. We'll see.
So are you kind of alluding to that, you know, as development goes into KWin for composite capabilities, that you might see a split then, whereas, you know, Barrel or Compass are not going to function properly on KDE, and KDE is going to have all that capability to do what Barrel and Compass do on its own and not work with Barrel or Compass?
Well, I don't think that's ever going to happen. That's why we have standards, right? We have standards for window management to actually make sure that window managers work across desktops. So that shouldn't be a problem. My issue is what happens by default on a KDE desktop, right? What happens when you initially start a KDE session? Which window manager do you start? Do you start a Compass or do you start K1 with Composite? And ideally, natural selection is going to take over here. Within 2 or 3 months, you're going to see one of those solutions being far superior to the others. So you're going to see distributions shipping that solution as the default. Right now, KDE works on both KWin and Barrel. It's work that mostly Dirk Miller did. So that should never be a problem. The fact that we have those specifications should help us immensely there. So those composition managers and window managers should work without problem. It's just, what do you do by default? That is the real question. What do you define as KDE 4? What do you define as the KDE setup? Do you say full KDE setup requires Compass, or do you say KWin is the window manager slash composition manager for the KDE desktop? If Lubos is persistent enough and he actually commits himself to keep doing what he's doing, meaning maintaining KWin with composition, and we have someone who actually is capable of doing the effects that are done in Compass and Barrel, I would say sure, go for our own solution. That would be great because we could keep the window management code that is already in KWin. But if we don't have that commitment from those types of people, then it's natural for us to look forward to that problem, and that solution would be to go with either Compass or Barrel and then have a fallback for systems that don't support OpenGL that says if you don't have OpenGL on your system, you're not getting composition management on your desktop. All you get is KWin without composition management, which would be basically a direct port of KWin to the KDE4 infrastructure. so you would have K1 working in the KD4 without composition manager at all. That might be an easier solution. I'm still not sure. It's something that probably Lubos, I, and Aaron have to sit down and talk about to see what exactly is necessary for making Plasma work and making Plasma work right, and getting the resources that we have and then putting them in a place where they're actually necessary and required rather than spreading our resources all over different projects that we can't possibly maintain. So it's an open question.
Speaking of KDE4, how is development going on KDE4?
It depends on what you define KDE4. To me, it goes great. We're doing a lot of work on the framework still because the framework is the core concept of KDE4 as a desktop. The question is, how do you define something that you have not released? So at which stage do you say, we're done, this is it? At which point do you cut off all the new features and say, this is what constitutes KD4? Every single group within KD4, from PIM, graphics, usability, accessibility, define very lofty goals for KD4. And all of those groups is working on something that is fairly unique and fairly complex. The question is, how do you combine all those features that all those groups set out for themselves and say that set of features is constituting KD4. Depending on how big set of the features you're going to define as the one defining KD4, you're going to have different answers. For me, I'm a big proponent of releasing as often as possible. So I would love to see KD4 with a very minimal set of features, which would mean that we're very well on our way. A lot of people says that we can only release KD4 when we have the full set of features, meaning a lot of the functionality that all those groups define has to be finished. I don't think that's realistic at this point. It's basically like doing waterfall in a lot of the major companies, including Microsoft. Right? You define a hard-coded schedule and you define hard-coded list of features. That just never works because you don't have full set of requirements to implement all those features. You don't know how long each one of those features is going to take, which is why I really love the concept of releasing as often as quickly as possible. You release as soon as you have something working, not compiling, but working to some extent. You release that with the minimal set of features that defines your application, that defines your library. If your library is supposed to do image manipulation, you release with just one filter just to show the architecture. People can play with it, right? Report your bugs, and then you release another where you either add a filter or just add some small amount of functionality, and that constitutes another release. And this way, you have the natural progression of your software where all the users and all the developers can see it progressing and seeing changing incrementally. If you just try to release something that is finished, basically, and feature complete, it's never going to happen because software is never finished. So, it really depends what you define as KD4. The way I would love to see it released, but again, I don't have any more saying in KD releases than any of the users do. KD is a community, right? So you don't have anyone with special powers. We have now the working group, which is supposed to address exactly that problem, meaning that up till now in KDE, we're all equals. So the fact that I wanted to release quickly and someone else felt like releasing later, there was no way to resolve that dispute. Right now we have technical working group, which is capable of making those decisions. They can come up and say those are the features that we think are crucial for release of KDE4 as a desktop, and those are the features that are hardcore requirements for releasing of KD4. Those are features that we have to implement. And that's something every single KD contributor has to agree with and just go with it, because it's a group that was elected in a fairly open fashion. All of us, all of the contributors who were members of KDEV, and all KD contributors should be members of KDEV, got to vote on that group, and we put tremendous trust in all those people. And we basically said that those are the people who are capable of making those decisions. So hopefully the technical working group is going to step up very soon and say those are the features that we think are going to be considered in KD4 desktop. And those are the features that we have to implement before KD4. This is where the deadline can be set for KD4, the release date. Right now we don't have one, right? That's one of the things people complain about, rightfully so. We should have a date when we say this is when KD4 is going to be complete. But because we still are not sure, or we argue about which features are actually considered in KD4, we can't set the date. Because while I say, well, we need 5 more months to actually get KD4 out, someone else will say, well, but the feature I'm working on will need another year. So unless technical working group is going to step in, I think we're going to have a hard time setting that release date. For me, we're doing very well. The things Aaron did in the framework, KD Lips is basically ported and it's done, which is why you have right now, you're seeing snapshots of KD Lips 4. And users are a little disappointed, right, because you don't see the functionality that goes into KD 4 before it's actually used by applications. It's one of the things that we'll have to do, meaning when KD 4 is released, besides the Plasma stuff that is obvious, we'll need to have applications that are actually using the new functionality. An obvious candidate for that is both Conquer and the KD PIM application. When you're talking about desktop, it's really difficult to omit web browser and to omit email client. They are crucial parts of your desktop. So those two applications will have to be polished to no end, and actually we have to make sure that we actually use the new functionality in KD Lib in those applications. We have a small project here at Choltec that we started last year. We're basically talking about file management, or more exact, the fact that it's really sad that a lot of the core people here at Choltec don't use Conquer for file management. It's one of my greatest sins. I still use a terminal to do pretty much all my file management. Although I've been working on Conquer for many, many years, I still find terminal a lot more flexible with regards to the things I can do. So we started defining a lot of the functionality that we would need from a file manager to actually make us productive, which is a pretty lofty goal because file managers are usually meant for, or they were designed for, users who are not very familiar with computers. And when you take that same metaphor and you try to apply it to people who are power users, basically, right, for people like us who sit in front of the computers most of the day, it's really difficult to make it work because that metaphor, like I said, was designed for people who are very, very different from us. So we would like to take that metaphor and change it a little bit so that actually file management is as productive for us in a fully graphical environment as it is in a terminal. It's an interesting problem. In a graphical environment, there's a lot of things you get, like previews for files. But there's also a lot of things that you don't get, meaning full keyboard navigation. And you have, obviously, all of us do a lot of the command line arguments and command line applications that we use all the time within our terminals that you just don't see in a graphical environment. It's something that we have to leverage. We have to make sure that all those things actually work correctly within the file manager. And it's the same with email clients. Email clients have been basically unchanged for the last 10 years, right? You see the folder view on your left, you see the message view somewhere on the top, and then you get the message preview somewhere probably on the bottom right. Whether that workflow is ideal is again questionable. In the Outlook, you're probably going to see now the left to right workflow, meaning on the left you have folders, then to the right of folders you have message headers, and further to the right you have the message view, the preview, a message preview. There was this really nice project from IBM called Remail, which was basically called Remail for reinventing email. They defined a lot of the problems that people have with email clients. They basically realized that more and more people is switching to using web-only email solutions like Gmail or Yahoo Mail or something along those lines. And they were trying to figure out what makes those solutions more comfortable to use than homebrewed email client? Why people are switching away from Outlook, why people are switching away from Mozilla Thunderbird, Evolution, or KML into those environments. And there is a lot of things that web solutions offer that web clients don't. You have that consistent view of all your messages. I mean, we are a very special group of people, right, because we tend to get hundreds of emails a day, right? A lot of us is subscribed to some mailing list sending commit announcements or release announcements and a lot of the development chatter on the mailing list. But most of the people doesn't do that. People don't subscribe to mailing lists that often. If they usually use web forms actually nowadays, right? You see a lot of the stuff from mailing lists being substituted by web forms. So a lot of the people, actually most of the people, is getting very few emails a day. So a consistent view of all those emails within that within the browser is very convenient for them because they can access it from every computer. It's for email clients, I think it's important to actually acknowledge that and somehow make it more attractive to use actual email clients than to use the web-based solutions. There's a lot of information on a desktop that you never get on the browser. A lot of the context that you get with your emails, a lot of the context that you get from your address book on your desktop, a lot of the context that you get from all your conversation on IRC or any other instant messaging network that you can associate with different entries in your address book and then get all that information and integrate it within your email client. So there's a lot of context with a lot of emails that comes in. And it's information that you can use to a great extent on a desktop and you don't have access to on web forums or web email solutions. And it's the question of whether we're capable of making it attractive enough so that people actually start switching back to email clients and to the desktop-based solutions rather than web applications. Clearly, there is a strong push for web applications right now with Ajax and a lot of the Ruby on Rails and stuff like that. And people tend to agree that a lot of those applications that we're seeing on web is actually pretty good. Except the whole Office Suite, I think that's a tremendous failure. I don't think that works at all. But you see more and more of those web applications coming up and pushing away the desktop solutions, the native applications on desktops. And we have to do something about that because those applications that you see on a desktop are usually faster and working more stable than they are within the browser. So how do you make those applications more attractive so that people are actually willing to use them and they don't look back, right? They don't say, I should have used the web solution because that was easier and I could have moved my stuff all over the place and accessed it from every computer. It's something that we obviously can't compete on based on. We don't have access to. You can edit your document on every computer, whether that application that you were editing your document with is present or not. It's something that those web solutions offer. So we have to offer opposing functionality, something that you can hold back and say, these are the things that you're not getting when you're using those web applications. And it's the thing that is going to pretty much be defining the desktop right now, right? Because web browser is present everywhere. So what exactly is defining you as a desktop environment? Is it the fact that you can start a web browser, or is it the fact that you can use a set of applications on the desktop that are not present anywhere else? And I think it's a switch that is very important for KDE. I talk to a lot of people, and I see a lot of people in coffee places, and they say, and I always ask them about the way they use computers and the way they work with applications, and they tend to say that it doesn't matter what desktop environment you're using because the set of applications is always the same. Whether you're using Windows or Linux, you're really looking for the same functionality, if you're at least a common user, right? You're using for basic Word document editing, you're looking for reading your emails, and you're looking for maybe joining some forums and discussing some things with your friends and instant messengers. Those are the things that everyone is looking for. And pretty much a solution has been presented for each one of them that is working within a browser. So what exactly is defining your desktop environment? Is it your browser? It can be, right, because for example, Mozilla Firefox works across desktops and across operating systems. So that would mean that it doesn't matter what desktop environment you're using or what operating system you're using, you still get the same functionality. So to make KD4 attractive as a desktop, we actually have to have applications that are KD-specific. They use the new functionality that we have, and they offer things that are not available on the web.
Wow, that was a mouthful.
Hey, that's what you get with me.
Oh, that's some... So what you're saying, in a nutshell, is it'll be released when it's released.
I think that's a very typical response to to all open source software. And I hate to give you that because I absolutely hate that message. I hate when people say it's going to be released when it's ready. I think KD4 should be released when it's not ready. I think KD4 should be actually released. It was something that we talked about actually on the hacking session that we had during summer here in Norway, when we pulled a lot of the core KD developers and we put them in a cabin in the middle of nowhere. And actually, Aaron and I did get vegetarian food, so we didn't starve, which was positive. And we were discussing how exactly are we going to release KD4. One of the problems with all the software is that if you see a 0.0 release, you're scared, right? Was there ever any software release that had major numbers 0.0 release that was actually usable? I don't think that ever happened. And it's very difficult to actually do that, right? Because, like I said, you have new functionality. You have new set of goals. You have new set of rules that governs your development process. And all those new features are composing a product that you're not familiar with. So you can't really define a schedule or a fixed set of goals or fixed set of features for it, because you have just a high-level plan of we're going to solve X, or we're going to solve B, and we're going to solve C, and we're going to solve them with W, X, and Y, and you don't know exactly what it takes to implement those things, so you can't set any of those hard requirements, goals, or schedules for it. I really don't want to give that answer. I would prefer to say within the next half a year, which hopefully the working group is not going to make me a liar, and is going to define a set of goals for KD4 small enough that we're actually capable of delivering it. But, yeah, it's going to really depend on what the working group is going to say at this point. Whether they're going to say that we actually have to have... One of the things that is difficult is that KDPIM people have just a wonderful, wonderful plan for what to do with applications in KD4. The framework that they developed so far, Econati, is really incredible. It's a storage system, personal information management system on the desktop that is capable of handling all kinds of different requests, from viewing emails through looking, searching through your address book, connecting different sets of data. Basically, it's almost like an indexer with a lot of context information. And it's a very lofty goal. And I think that part would be difficult to finish in 6 months. I think it's such a tremendous idea that it actually deserves a little bit more time to actually finish and develop correctly. One of the problems with applications is that if you release a first version of application and your application doesn't really work, or it crashes, or there are problems with it, people are going to be very, very quickly discouraged, and they're never going to try your application again. And I'm afraid something like that could happen with Econati and the new set of PIM applications. The idea
behind...
How about
is it going to be fast?
Actually, it's one of the
things...
Like,
that's one of the things that I want to know. You know, all the new KDE stuff that's coming out, I know that I was really impressed by the last couple of releases of KDE, because my initial memory of it was that it was slow, you know, and I believe I coined the term, like, ass slow. When it originally started, just like a few years back, right? Recently, I've been using it a lot, and it's really, really fast. But I noticed that everybody that starts doing these these desktop search things and the index engines and all that crap. All that stuff is, you know, that's a lot of overhead, and it starts slowing things down. And, like, I don't want to lose the speed of my desktop either. And not everybody has a 3 gigahertz machine, right? So.
Right. It's actually very interesting that you mentioned that, because lately I've been working a little bit on WebKit, which is the Apple version of KHTML, basically. And it's an open source project right now. And one of the policies they define for that project is zero tolerance for performance regression. And it's something that I would like to push for KDE right now, actually, as well. I'm probably going to send that email in a few days to KDE Core. It's a very neat policy. It basically says that if you're developing a feature, that feature will not be accepted, or you're fixing a bug, that code is not going to be accepted in the repository if it causes any kind of performance regression. Performance regressions are not acceptable. There is just no need and no excuse for them. And I think it's a very interesting policy, and it's something that we should adopt for KDE as well, meaning every single feature that goes in KDE right now cannot cause performance regression. The stuff we did right now and the things we did with KDE, with Qt 4, we made sure that Qt 4 applications actually start up a lot faster than Qt 3 applications did. So Qt 4 is faster than Qt 3 used to be because of the changes in the tool classes, because of the changes in the graphics framework, because of the changes in the object in the object hierarchies. A lot of the things that we did in Qt 4 was meant to actually make sure things are faster. And a lot of the things that happen in KDE is actually going along the same path, meaning KDE 4 right now, at least the code base in KDE Libs and Qt 4, is a lot faster than the same equivalent in KDE 3. With Akonadi, meaning the stuff that KDE PIM is doing, it's a whole new problem. So it really depends on what kind of functionality were you using in your email client or in your organizer up till now, right? The core feature set of PIM applications is usually composed of having virtual folders, meaning, you know, or virtual folders slash search folders, however you define them. Either way, it's that concept where you define custom folders that basically store messages which match certain search criteria. So, like, they come from person A, or they have word B in the subject line, or they come from the mailing list X. So that indexing is already happening within your email client. So there's nothing new in that framework. It's just putting it in a common spot where not only email client that is using that information can access it, but a lot more information, a lot more applications. So if you have an instant messenger, you can ask that storage framework for the email conversations that you had with the person that you're just talking, or for the rest email that you had from that person. And it's going to go through the same code that your email client would use to actually set up your virtual folders or your search folders. It's the same functionality. It's just exposed towards a more global set of applications than what we had in KDE 3.
Well, are you gonna lose all that functionality then if you don't use KDE specific clients? Like, say I use Thunderbird for my email. You know, are you gonna lose all of that functionality, or are you guys working with other programmers as well, you know, to...
Right, of course. It's actually something that these guys have been talking to the guys behind Evolution. They want to share that data storage, and which is one of the things that is really exciting about it, is the fact that it has all the potential to be cross-desktop. There is nothing in the storage system that is really desktop-specific. They want to communicate over IMAP with the applications, which makes sense, and then add some kind of a dbus interface to it, which is basically, it's exactly the same functionality that you get right now in Evolution Data Server. Evolution Data Server is basically doing what Akonadi would be doing for Evolution. It's not doing it in a desktop-wide fashion. It's functionality that has been obviously needed by both GNOME and KDE. So if we have that desktop desktop unaware solution, meaning it's working across desktops. I think Thunderbird and every single email client that is out there should start using that for its managing of emails. Not only because it actually makes it a little bit simpler to actually maintain Thunderbird or your any custom email client, but because it gives you that option of storing the same set of information no matter what kind of email client are you using in a desktop or a fashion. But it requires some work from the applications. So if you would be using an email client that doesn't use the same data storage, you're taking that ahead. And another question is, right, whether that framework should be capable of handling the cases where people are not using default configurations. That is exactly where this more than 6 months comes in, right? Because, like I said, writing a prototype is always very simple. So writing something that just works on your setup is very trivial. But writing something that works across different configurations, especially ones that you don't have access to, that is really what makes the product complete and actually very difficult to finish. Because I think personally that Econati is not going to take more than 3 or 4 months to actually do. But I think it's going to take another 3 or 4 months to actually get it to a stage where it's usable in those different configurations and actually defining the set of features and behavior on all those different configurations.
Right, because you know we're all you know root for KDE and especially if you're going to increase the speed and stuff like that. Like I'm an old hack computer user. I remember running a desktop GUI on a Commodore 64. Like you ran the whole damn GUI in 64K of RAM, and you know it was functional and usable then. And at this point, you know we're up to 3.2 gigahertz machines or whatever with multi-gigabyte of RAM, and I see things like slowing down. I hate to see that, you know?
Yeah. I think it's really actually cool one of the reports can, I keep getting.
You know. Right.
I see that a lot. Actually, we are fortunate enough at Toltec to actually have embedded version of Qt, right? So you get people using it on devices that are vastly inferior to your desktop configuration. And there was a lot of functionality that I implemented in Qt with regards to graphics that worked beautifully on my desktop. And then I had people coming over to my office and saying, yeah, this stuff doesn't work on my phone, man. There's a lot of people using Qt Embedded on their phones, right? And then they see those applications, and they're like, yeah, I've seen the application that you wrote yesterday, the demo. But, yeah, that thing is basically like a slideshow on my phone. It doesn't work at all. And you have to sit down and try to figure out how to make this damn thing actually works on all those devices. So it's one of the good things about having an embedded version of your application. You actually get to see how well it actually performs on all their hardware.
Sounds good to me.
Oh, actually, I have a pretty cool. I was talking to Harold Fernagel today. He's a person who does accessibility stuff for KDE, and he was playing with his green phone. Because he ported Dasher. Are you familiar with the Dasher application for GNOME initially? Yep. It's this really cool application for actually for writing without a keyboard basically. It's a accessibility application for actually for writing without a keyboard and just using mouse database navigation. And it's really wonderful. So he ported that application to his green phone, which is actually very, very cool because one thing I always hated about writing messages on my phone was the fact that I don't have a full keyboard, so I have to be typing those numbers, right? I always found that very, very painful. And in Europe, for whatever reason, SMS is big, so everyone uses it, so you have to respond to those messages. And having a Dasher on a phone working as well as it does, especially since green phone has a touch screen. So it worked beautifully, and the animation that he had in there, and it's all anti-alias, and it actually worked. It made me so happy because it just worked. You know, it was the first time I think I've seen my graphics code just working on an embedded device. And people were like, "Look how cool it is!" I was like, "Holy crap, this thing actually works! That's awesome!" And it's a very nice application. Actually, is was meant as an accessibility application. superior desktop for people who are not capable of using the desktop in the same way that you are, and it makes that desktop usable for them. And it's suddenly ported to the phone, and it's usable by everyone. It makes typing on a phone so much easier and so much more fun. Plus, it just looks great. So it was so nice to see actually him doing it. I was telling him that he needs to actually blog and post pictures of this stuff, and he promised me he will. So hopefully tomorrow he's going to do that, because it's really cool how we can take a desktop application that would be usable to a specific and predefined set of users on the desktop, but suddenly port it to an embedded device like the phone, and it makes the whole desktop experience on the phone so much better and so much nicer, and it's available to all the users at the same time as it is on the desktop. So it's really nice.
Good stuff.
There's a question on the RC stack. People asking, will they ever come out with a KDE Lite, something that's lightweight and quick that has all the KDE components in it?
It's a good question. I thought about it for the longest time, and then I decided that it doesn't make sense to fork off KDE to produce KDE Lite. I think we should be able to produce KDE that is a lot lighter than the default configuration without actually altering anything in KDE. So if a distribution would want to actually do that, they should be able to do that. For example, if they would want to say, we don't want to have a composition manager, or we don't want to have those special eye candy effects, or we don't want to have that kind of image manipulation, they should be able to easily remove that functionality without removing the core functionality of the whole desktop and just use that. So I don't think within KDE project, I don't think it's in the best interest of KDE to actually split off a different version of KDE and work on that. I think it's something to do with the way you distribute KDE. If your distribution is going to define itself as a minimal distribution, or if you as a user are going to say that you won't want packages for minimal installation of KDE, it's up to the distribution to decide what parts of KDE constitute that minimal
activate
setup.
Interlock.
And it's up
Dino
to KDE
connected.
To make sure that this setup actually works. So connecting those pieces that are necessary to be running that minimal desktop actually is possible and works in the same way that a full-fledged KDE session would work. So I think that would work a lot better, meaning we just make sure our functionality works. And then distributions define what parts of that functionality actually constitutes a KDE desktop on that given distribution.
So if you want KDE Lite, you should run XFCE, right?
I would never recommend that, ever. Personally, I wouldn't mind seeing just a Q4-based window manager. Actually, I wrote one here. One of the people at the office here is Brad, who is the author of Blackbox. So between the two of us, we have enough X experience to actually write one. But we haven't gotten to it so far, because I've been getting that request from a lot of people who are actually working with Linux on set-top boxes or in embedded devices. They really don't want to run a whole KDE session, but they need some kind of window management. So they've been asking whether it's possible to have just a panel or some kind of window manager and then be running the Qt and KDE application on the desktop. And we don't really have a good solution to that problem. You have to use some other window manager like Enlightenment or like Fluxbox or any of the smaller ones like XFCE, for example. XFCE is more a desktop environment than a window manager, just it's a very similar problem. I think I would be I'm not sure if you guys read the benchmarks that Lubus did that said that KDE is basically just as fast in starting up as XFCE. So if we can make sure that there is no performance regressions and KDE4 is actually working faster, that means that those benchmarks are going to again change and KDE will be even faster. So at that point, does it really make sense to create another desktop environment and another window manager, knowing that KDE is anyway the fastest desktop environment to be running right now? So I would I would prefer to go for that, meaning make sure KDE is the fastest, instead of forking off and creating new project, because it would be solving basically the same problems that you have to solve in KDE right now anyway, right? You want to make sure the thing works fast. So I think it's easier to optimize something that is already there than to write something from scratch and then optimize it.
You know, I caught in your conversation, not to steer away from the technology too much, way back about half an hour ago, that you said you had some kind of vegetarian food. Are you a vegetarian?
Yes, I am.
How difficult is it to be a vegetarian in Norway? Because that doesn't seem like a very, I don't know, for lack of a better word, agricultural state. That it would be easy to get anything that's not like fish. Or
yeah, that was really nicely put. Yeah. Norway is not famous for their vegetarian food, which seems to be pretty common to a lot of countries that I went to in Europe, actually. It's difficult. Basically, being vegetarian in Norway means that you're willingly submitting to starvation. And that's pretty much what I'm doing. It's really difficult to get vegetarian food. It's almost impossible. So the level of commitment I'm showing to actually stay vegetarian here in Norway is tremendous. I eat mostly bread and cheese, and that's pretty much it. There are two vegetarian places in the city that are not really great, but at least there's something. Obviously, you can't really go to them every single day because the food is more or less the same. So there's only so much mixed vegetables they can eat in a week. So it's difficult. Norway definitely, as beautiful as it is, the food is definitely offsetting that beauty of the country. And it's a complaint I actually heard from not only vegetarians. It's difficult to get, especially if you're coming from U.S., right, where we do have a lot of incredible food. You come to Norway and suddenly, first of all, there's no diners here. These guys don't have pancakes or Belgian waffles at all. You can't get breakfast here. Like, it just doesn't exist. If you want a breakfast, you have to just do it yourself or you're done. They just don't have any places that open up early in the morning, period. So if you...
No Perkins?
If you hear... What?
No Perkins?
Yeah, there's no Perkins. I couldn't believe that. They don't even have Dunkin' Donuts, so you can't even get donuts in the morning. It's
That's
really bizarre.
Right
and
there.
Yeah, I want my pancakes. I need my Belgian waffles, and I can't get them, man. Or even scrambled eggs. I would kill for scrambled eggs in the morning. You can send me a care package with eggs. I'm sure that would work well, but I'm going to get it in like 2 weeks.
So what do they eat over there? I mean, like, what's the cuisine?
One of my friends, who's actually Norwegian, so hopefully Norwegians will not hold it against me if I say that, but he keeps saying that... The best thing to do is just catch a fish and then bury it behind the shed for like 6 months and then salt it before, and that's pretty much the native Norwegian food that you can get. But short of that, there's really not a lot. The bread is very different than it is. And one thing that is really, really interesting about food in Norway is they only have two kinds of cheese. They have yellow cheese, which is actually defined as yellow cheese, and they have brown cheese. And brown cheese is basically like a mix of caramel and cheese. And that's how you can actually recognize someone who's from Norway, because they always love brown cheese. And if you're not from Norway, you tend to hate it, because it's a weird mix of something that is sweet and cheese. So it's very peculiar. I've never seen brown cheese before in my life. And the fact they only have one kind of yellow cheese is also very suspicious. But, so being vegetarian, if you're vegetarian and coming to Norway, like, you tend to be in a lot of pain if you don't cook. Because, yeah, it's not only the fact that I'm vegetarian, it's the fact that I refuse to cook that is really the problem. Because, I don't cook for a very simple reason. I never want to eat anything that I would make. It's just not a sound decision to make on any kind of level. Yeah, I'm a horrible cook, and I really don't want to be learning how to cook. It's problematic, at least for me.
So what brought you all the way out there to Norway?
Trolltech did. They really wanted me to work. But, the policy in Trolltech is that if you work on Qt itself, you need to be in Norway, because it makes a lot of sense, right, to have the team working on the same code base in the same place. You have all the people who work on Qt in the same office, or in the same building. And offices right next to each other. So if there's a problem popping up in something that I did, which obviously never happens because my code is absolutely perfect, but if that would happen, right, they have the option of just coming to my office and complaining. And if something breaks, for example, in the list view classes, or if something breaks in one of the widget classes, I can go to the author right now and then yell at him. So that works really well. And it's the policy, so all the Qt work that is being done is done in Oslo. All the work that is done on tools is done in Berlin. And those are the two main development offices. And then most of the, pretty much all of the Qtopia work is done on in Australia. So we have Qtopia in Australia, Qt in Oslo, and the tools in Berlin. It's a division that actually works very well. And it's, like I said, it's really nice to have the option of going and complaining to people who actually break the code at the same time it's actually broken, and do it face-to-face. One thing that usually happens when you talk via emails is that it's hard to decipher whether people are being friendly or whether they're just being assholes. And a lot of the face-to-face communication is helping with that. So, and I tend to be really bad at it, actually. It's one of my, I tend to get really quickly irritated on mailing lists. Because I have a lot to do, and if I'm reading an email that sounds stupid, I'm like, you just wasted 15 seconds of my life. So I tend to respond in a very sarcastic fashion. So I tend to respond in a very sarcastic fashion, and since we are a community that prides itself in being smart and having huge egos, that doesn't cope well with understanding of a lot of people that they have of me. So a lot of people just absolutely hate and implores me for my emails. They're always very, very sarcastic and usually funny, but not funny to the person that I'm sending it to. So it's a lot easier to talk face-to-face than it is on mailing lists, especially if you have language barriers, right? Most of the people on mailing lists is not native speakers, so it's even more difficult for them to decipher what the hell are you talking about. And a company like Trolltech, well, you do have people from all over the world. It's crucial to have that kind of face-to-face communication.
Do you find this problem over there with different languages? Are the employees, or are they all
At Trolltech, the official language is English, so we only speak English at the office, which is actually a problem, right? Because if you move to Norway, or if you move to any country, period, where a different language is spoken than your native language, ideally you would want to learn that language at some point. But since I spend most of my time at the office, and I mostly hang out with people I know from work, so we only speak English. So it's insanely difficult to actually find that Norwegian that would be willing to speak Norwegian to you. Because as soon as they figure out that you speak English, it's done. Like, the conversation switches to English instantaneously. Because everyone wants to practice their English, so no one wants to speak Norwegian. And Norwegians
anybody in the office playing tricks on you, like writing "I'm a dork" in Norwegian and sticking it on your back or something like that?
No, actually, you don't have that, you know, because that would be so motivating. You just, everyone is too nice here. I think that's the problem.
Well, I'll tell you what, you come to my office and I'll write it for you. I don't even know if I know what you know. I'll look it up.
Oh, I really appreciate that. It's really cute.
Hey, Zach, we got a question. What languages do you prefer to code in? We know Qt is C++, and a lot of the X stuff is written in C.
I don't have a preference when it comes to language. One of the things that people always consider very weird about me is that I do maintain KDE Emacs because I like Lisp. From the languages I work with, I really like C++, although it's a really difficult language to actually master because it's a huge language. I'm not a big fan of Objective-C, and I've been staying at a lot of Objective-C lately, and I'm just not a big fan of the syntax. The syntax is horrible, although the language features are really nice. The language is horrible. I really like C because it's very, very simple, and it's very quick to learn, but it takes a while to actually program efficiently in C and understand all the quirks of the language. I really like Java as well. I think Java as a language is really great. One of the people here at the office, Roberto, he's probably one of the best compiler designers I've ever seen. He writes C parsers and C++ parsers for fun. And writing, if you ever tried writing C++ parser, it's freaking difficult. It's, I think the only language that has more bizarre semantics is Perl, right? Especially Perl 6, because parsing that language is insane. And C++ is not a lot better. So Roberto is writing parsers for fun. And he's one of the biggest Java fans ever. Not because he likes the language, but because writing compiler and interpreter for Java is trivial. The language was designed with simplicity in mind, and it just works really nice. So I've been, I did write some demos for Qtjambi, and we have the Java port of Qt, which is scheduled to be released pretty soon. Because I am the graphics guy, I did some demos for it, and working with Java is a lot of fun, and I wish I could do more of the high-level coding. I really love Ruby as well. When Richard Dale started working on the Qt and KD Ruby bindings, I was very excited, and those bindings are great. I wrote two applications with them, and they both work fantastically. So Ruby is a great language. I never really liked PHP that much. It's I think one of the things that is, I differ from, I just don't like the syntax or semantics of PHP. Just never was a big fan. And I think C# is actually a very interesting language. The work that Mono people did on the MCS compiler is actually very, very impressive. And their interpreter is actually really good at at least bootstrapping the code. I'm not sure how well it runs after running the application for a few hours. I haven't tested that. But C# in itself is also a fairly interesting language. Besides that, I don't really use that many new languages. Granted, that is already a fair amount. But yeah, as far as my preference, it probably goes C++, C, Java, Ruby, and C#. At least that's the order I would be coding in right now. Granted, a lot of the work I have to do is still in assembly because of the device drivers, but that is not a language I would ever pick for writing anything.
Have you looked at Python at all?
Yeah. The reason I didn't mention it is, although I liked a lot of things about the language, one thing I absolutely hate is whitespace-sensitive languages. I just can't bring myself to actually doing that because I appreciate the ability to use wonky indention, and in Python it's really difficult. I just don't like whitespace sensitive languages. Plus, the way they handle Unicode in Python is really bizarre. I mean, because you have to write you have to import a special module, and then you have to specify your application is running with Unicode strings. Otherwise, it's always less than one text. That is not ideal, especially for desktop applications. So, plus the comparison between Unicode and the less than one strings is suddenly changing semantics when you do that. I was always very confused about the Unicode handling in Python, and I think that's going to be a problem for OOPC. I'm actually not sure how they handle it, because I'm sure they tackled that problem and they solved it somehow. But how exactly they did is I'm not sure. One of the discussions that we had right after FISL, which was the Free Software Conference in Brazil, we were sitting on the airport, and it was Keith Packard, Chris Blizzard, Aaron Saigo, and I. And we started talking about having one scripting language that could be used across desktops. And Chris mentioned the fact that at OLPC they use Python. And we talked a little bit about different alternatives that you have to Python. And for scripting purposes on a desktop, you don't really have that much. You have only Ruby. And so it's a question between Python and Ruby. And since you have at least right now, more projects using Python than you do Ruby. Python would be probably the more natural solution to the problem of having a consistent scripting environment for all desktops. It's one thing that Microsoft has over us, right? They have Visual Basic, and that's the language they actively support on Windows. We don't have the same kind of language on Linux desktop. We don't have a language that is the official scripting language, which, depending on how you look at it, is both bad and good. It's good for us. It's bad for newcomers to the Linux desktop because they tend to get confused. Having a lot of options is good. Having a lot of options when you're not aware of any of them is confusing. So either you need better documentation and better way of conveying the message that these are the languages that are good for scripting on Linux, and these are the functionality they offer, and make your selection based on those very high-level ideas. Or we need one language that has the blessing of both GNOME and KDE, and we both actively support our bindings, and we push that as the official solution. It was a discussion also we had on the KDE core list, where we're trying to define what scripting languages are we going to support for KDE4. And the idea that Aaron and I had was very simple, and it was for embedded scripting purposes, we use JavaScript. For writing applications, we use Python. And of course, a lot of people stepped up and said, well, I like Ruby more, or I like Java more, or I like C# more, and I like this more. So someone else stepped in and said, hey, I'm working on that library, which is actually KOffice library, that would allow you to have any kind of scripting language embedded in your application or any kind of scripting bindings developed for KDE. So it's a framework that basically can bind all the languages. And people were pretty excited about that. The question is whether supporting many, many languages is better than supporting one language really, really well. For me, I don't think so. I think it would be better if we decided on one language and supported that and had the clear message by which we say, this is the language that we support, this is the language that we recommend, and this is the language that you're probably going to achieve most if you're going to use. It doesn't mean we couldn't have other bindings for the desktop, right? It doesn't mean that we couldn't have Lisp or Haskell or Ruby or Pascal bindings for KDE. It just means we would have a very clear and concise message saying, this is the official scripting language that we support. And for newcomers, that would be a lot better. But yeah, for that purposes, I think, even though, like I said, I'm not a big fan of Python because of the white space and Unicode issues, I think it is the best language right now we have for very very straightforward, simple scripting and writing and high-level development of rapid application development of applications. So I think Python for that is great. For embedded purposes, I still prefer JavaScript. But so I think that would be ideal, having Python and JavaScript as two officially supported binding languages.
So that one
still
language...
Still running Debian Unstable?
Excuse me?
You still running Debian Unstable?
Yeah, yeah. I actually got a new laptop. I just bought a Sony Vaio SV. So I went through the whole installation procedure, and I specifically got the Unstable net install because I was hoping to be able to get the graphical installer. I was like, you know, I've never installed Debian in a graphical fashion. I would love to see that graphical installer that I keep hearing about. And of course it was not on it, so I got really disappointed. But I installed it, and of course, as with Debian, I had to do some magic to actually get it working. I would never switch to a different distribution. I just really appreciate the community concept of Debian. And as far as, like I said, using GNU Linux, the only thing I really want from a distribution is good libc and good GCC support, because those are the two things I'm really not a big fan of compiling myself. But everything else I have to compile myself anyway, right? When I work on X, I have to compile X. When I work on Qt, I have to compile Qt, and I work on KDE, so I have to compile KDE. So pretty much the whole stack has to be compiled by me anyway. So I just want stable and good libc, and I want stable and good GCC, and for those things, Debian maintainers are amazing. So I think I'm going to stick with Debian for a while to come.
So that one language to rule them all, then, you would probably throw your bid in for GTK, right?
Hey, that's technically not a language, that's a library.
This is true.
With mono bindings.
Yeah, there it is. Actually, it's not a bad solution. It's always something that I find intriguing about GNOME. They do have writing desktop applications in C sucks ass. And it's one thing I refuse to do. It was the main reason why I picked KDE. If you look at GTK or Pango old changelogs, you probably will find my name. When I switched to Linux initially, and I installed GNU Linux distribution, that was, I think, Debian 1.4 or something, 1.5 maybe. So when I installed that, I actually started contributing to GNOME first. But after a while, I couldn't handle writing desktop applications in C. It was too painful for me, which was the main reason why I switched to KDE. And now, GNOME has really good C# runtime, and they have really good GTK sharp bindings, and they still develop in C. And although I hugely respect the commitment they show towards the language, it's really time to actually use something else. And it's really interesting, right, because you have one company who basically controls Mono right now, and that's Novell. And then you get two other big players in GNOME, which is Red Hat and Sun. And these guys are not happy about giving the control over a lot of the GNOME development to Novell. So I think they're in a very interesting situation right now. They have to pick something. That is the bottom line, which is probably the same thing KDE has to do. Although I think C++ is a good language. It's not a great language for newcomers, like I said. It is a very difficult language. And I think Qt leverages a lot of that hardship of actually learning the language and allows you to write applications quickly. I still think we need a more high-level language, a lot more high-level language for developing desktop applications, which is either Python or or Ruby. And GNOME will have to do the same thing, developing applications in C, or C++ for that matter, for newcomers is just too difficult and too cumbersome. People don't want to do it. And there's a lot of applications that simply don't require the kind of performance you would get from statically typed languages. Furthermore, actually, I did some testing because I wanted to show basically that a lot of the things that you do in C++ is simply faster than you can achieve with Java, and I've seen a lot of the benchmarks that people have comparing Java and C++, and they were basically always unfair. Every single time I looked at those benchmarks, it was just embarrassing. So I wanted to check it for myself, and there was not one test that I found. And I was testing Java 1.6, which is Mustang, with C++ on GCC 4.1, and there was not one test that was really conclusive. Meaning interpretive languages are getting really, really good at doing stuff that you would normally see on a typical desktop application. So performance is not really an issue. I think Java is getting a lot of the bad rap for the fact that startup takes a lot of time. But once the application is running, the speed difference is not noticeable between C++ applications and Java applications, to be honest. There is a little bit of difference, but the difference is basically noticeable on the desktop. there's a lot more things that take a lot more time and a lot more time consuming than just, you know, issuing those calls on a Java stack. And it's the same with C Sharp. So I don't think speed is the issue. It's just making sure that we're giving new users ability to develop new applications quickly and in a very friendly environment. For GNOME, it would seem it's an obvious solution, right? They have Mono. But like I said, for political reasons and with the whole patent issue now, I think it's going to be problematic for them to select also between C-sharp and Java and selecting one of them as the official language. I think just like for KDE, it's more going to be this natural evolution approach, or natural selection, I mean, where you have a couple of different solutions, right? On KDE, we have the Python KDE, we have the Ruby KDE bindings. And with time, one of the solutions is going to show its superiority, not by the fact that one of them is better, but by the fact that one of them is going to get a really good application, because that is what defines a framework. It's not what you can do within the framework. It's what people already achieved with the framework that is actually defining the framework. You define the framework by the types of applications that are constructed based upon it. C-sharp, GDK C-sharp bindings and with Mono already have a couple of very impressive applications that could be used to define it. I'm not sure if Java GNOME have the same set of applications. I know for KDE the situation is a little bit more difficult because we don't have particular applications written in any of the binding languages. So picking for us between any of the binding languages is virtually impossible. Right? You want to have that application based upon which you can judge those frameworks. GNOME already has that framework with those applications. So it would seem the solution is obvious, but yeah, what I find interesting is that it's not, because of a lot of those of the mailing lists and of the official blog issues that you just don't get to see, which is the political struggles within the project, or at least that's what it seems to me. So yeah, interesting.
So what do you think, you had mentioned C-sharp, and, you know, that goes hand-in-hand with Mono. What do you think, is there a stormy future for C-sharp and Mono in light of Novell's partnership with Microsoft?
I think Mono is a great project. I really do. A question of whether that deal was a good thing. I think Novell had to make it for a very simple reason. They're a company. They're not an open source company. They happen to buy two open source companies, which doesn't make Novell an open source company. It just makes them a company that happened to buy two open source companies. There's a difference between being an open source company, like for example Red Hat, and being a company that happened to buy two open source companies. It's what you do after you buy those open source companies that defines you as either an open source or not open source company. In the beginning, it seemed like they were going for being the open source company. Right now, I don't think they do anymore for a very simple reason. The market they were going for, at least in the United States, which is their main market, is dominated by Red Hat. The enterprise market for GNU Linux desktop is dominated in the United States by Red Hat, and they had to do something because they're a company. And number one priority of any company is to make money for their investors. So it was very obvious they absolutely have to do something that differentiates them from all the other Linux distributions, at least in the United States. They had to have that ace to show that they have something to offer when it comes to Linux desktop that none of the other Linux vendors can offer. I think, unfortunately for us, they picked a really bad solution, although they do have a history of making those bad calls. This is not the first time Novell made a deal with Microsoft, a deal that will most likely, just like all the others, prove disastrous to Novell. Every single time they had one of those deals, they had one for NetWare and they had one for the Office Suite, and both of them proved to be huge failures for them. So they got screwed on both of them. I don't think they've learned a lesson. Maybe this is going to be different. I definitely don't want to be trying to foresee the future here or predict some disastrous scenarios for either one. I think the deal in itself was bad for Novell, and it's not great as a basically marketing image for the open source community. But like I said, I think they had to do something. They absolutely had to, because like I said, they need to start making money for the investors. They are making profits, I think, right now, or at least they used to last time I checked. But like I said, the market they were going for was saturated by other companies. So they had no leverage in that market, and they had to find something. And like I said, that solution was just not great. But this is not the first time they've made that call. And for Mono, I think now it's going to be a little bit more problematic to get into GNOME than it used to be, because at least from the blogs that I've seen, people are militantly opposed to that deal that Novell made. And I feel really bad for some of the GNOME Linux hackers that are working for Novell, because they have to be defending that decision. I know Miguel was trying to, and I think that is going to have to address the issue, at least on the common conferences. But in the open source community, we have a tendency to be very, very negative. So for companies who do something bad, it's really difficult to get the trust and respect of the community back. And I think it's going to prove very hard for Novell to prove again that they are an open source dedicated company, or at least they added a lot of problems for themselves. Granted that adoption of Mono by the open source community is probably not on the top of their list, right? It's not something they will be getting money from. How many of us are going to pay for developing with Mono, something that is free? Obviously, none of us. So they're obviously going for the commercial market. And for the commercial market, that decision made sense. For commercial market, it makes sense because it gives them something none of the other Linux distributions can offer, and it gives companies enough of the safety for the next few years to actually make them pick Novell over all the other solutions. And if a company is developing .NET applications, they're definitely more willing to try Mono now, knowing that they have the safety. And it is semi-officially acknowledged by Microsoft to be the other .NET implementation. And I think that is one thing that they were going for. You want to see some of those commercial .NET applications working with Mono on the Novell desktop. And like I said, that decision itself made sense for the commercial and their business perspective. It was really bad for the open source, and it's going to prove very difficult for them now to convince that Mono, coming from Novell, is the right solution for GNOME. So I'm not sure how Nat and Miguel are going to solve that problem. I think it's a shame that we can't judge solution based on its technical merits anymore. Granted, this is open source, and at least 60% of the things we do is based on politics, right? A lot of the things that we are doing, both as developers and users, is fully based on politics, not on technical aspects of it. So it was to be expected, but it's a shame because it is a really impressive framework, and a thing that would help tremendously GNOME to actually use it. Like I said, after the blogs I've read so far, it's going to be problematic because you will have people who are outright hostile towards Novell after what they did. So they will fight against anything they push. So they will fight against Mono. hopefully they can solve that. But like I said, for open source, that deal was just a bad decision all around.
Zach, thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. No, especially it's the middle of the night over in Norway.
Yeah, 4 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah, go get some sleep, man.
I was gonna say, get some sleep.
You guys are always welcome to come on the show. The KDE crew do a fantastic job, and we're all looking forward to seeing, you know, how KDE 4 looks and works. I'm sure we really got high expectations from you guys. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
You better not let us down.
Sure you're not disappointed.
Yeah, you better not let
us. Have I ever?
No, never. Not yet. Unless Trolltech decides to make a deal good. With a certain proprietary company.
No, if that would ever happen, that would be the day I would quit. You have my word for it. I am so dedicated to open source. There's I don't think there's ever been any doubt about me having could only work for an open source company. I could never do commercial software just because I'm weird like that, right? I'm a vegetarian living in Oslo to be able to work on open source software. So my commitment is lying there with the open source. And then, the reason I switched to Linux, it's probably a little different from other people. I keep hearing from a lot of people I talk to, and they give me the reason for switching to Linux as being sick with Windows, which is kind of unfortunate if you think about it, because we're trying to create something really special and something really fabulous. And it's really difficult to create something unique and something great on top of a foundation that is negative. And being sick of something is a negative feeling you have towards something. I switched to the Linux not because I was sick of Windows, it's because I was hoping I can do a lot of the things better, and GNU Linux was a way of me actually doing that, right? I could take the code, I could work on it, and I could commit it, and people would be using it the same day I would do it. That is not something any of the other companies or any of the movements could offer me. I could not call Microsoft and say, hey, my name is Zach, and I would like to come in and redo your desktop. Although I probably could do it, it's just I don't think they would go for it. So I switched to Linux because it gave me the opportunity to work on or improving the desktop experience. I don't think I could ever switch back to doing something else. So hopefully, we will not disappoint with KD4. And if we will, I will come down to the studio with you guys so we can kick my ass.
You got it. Thanks a lot. We really appreciate it.
It's not a problem. It was actually kind of fun. Because actually I was downtown, and so yeah, I walked back to the office. I'm now sitting in the office at 4 a.m. in the morning. And I think I'm going to brag about that tomorrow at work. I'll be like, oh, I was in the office at 4 a.m. in the morning. That's how dedicated I am to this company.
What you got to do, man? So. You got to shoot some emails off. Let them know that, you know, timestamp 4 a.m.
How are you going to brag? How are you going to brag tomorrow? It already is tomorrow for you. That's like a bad dream.
That's a good point.
That's a bad dream, waking up in the office at 4 a.m. and realizing you have to be at work in like a couple hours, and you're already there.
might as well just crawl underneath the desk and go to sleep.
Actually, we do have couches, so it's not a problem. I can take a sleep here. Plus, I can do some work and then, you know, have a commit at 4 a.m. in the morning and then show it off to everyone tomorrow. Today. That's pretty impressive, isn't it?
Yeah, more power to you. You're going to be dead tomorrow.
Yeah.
Come 3 o'clock.
Well, see, my plan is to ask for a raise tomorrow. I'm going to commit something right now and then go tomorrow and say, see, I've been working till 4 a.m. in the morning. I think I'm worth a lot more.
Well, good luck on that. Yeah, so thanks. Thanks a lot. Hopefully we can have you come on again in the future.
Yeah, I would love to. Anytime, guys.
It's been great. Thank you very much.
You're very, very welcome. All right, so I'm going to bed now.
Okay.
See you guys tomorrow.
Get some
good
sleep.
Night.
Yeah.
Good night. Well, right. Good morning.
Good night.
Good morning or good night. Yeah.
See you.
All right, bye.
All right.
You know what? Before Link goes off, I just wanted to say something you know, about that whole Novell and Microsoft thing. One of the things that I'm really interested in, we had a couple of people say in the IRC about trying to get some Novell guys on, is I'm really curious, you know, what a lot of those people that we've had on in the past and some of the guys we spoke with, what their take is on this and whether they could actually speak out and whether there's going to be some fallout, because I know the Samba organization recently, you know, put out a request for Novell to reconsider their partnership there, and they have some significant Samba developers in Novell. I mean, are they going to still stick with Novell, or, you know, what's going to go on with them? And is anybody going to present a dissenting opinion from inside the ranks of Novell?
The Samba guys have. Did you read that?
I read that the Samba guys have, but is actually, who's that developer that they have that works in Novell? We had him on the show.
We had Jeremy Allison.
Yeah, Jeremy Allison. I mean, what's he saying? Is he, you know, is he still going to work for Novell then, or?
He might not. Who knows? He might be working for some shortly.
No.
Or Google, for that matter.
I don't know.
You guys hear me now?
You were there?
Just ignore him. Maybe he will think we can't hear him.
Yeah, right. that's the one major hang-up about these phones. Is like they don't tell you when your mute is on and when it's off. So, like, I could have been talking for the last half a freaking hour here, and no one even knew.
Oh, dead space, man. You know, something new.
Yeah.
We're used
nothing
to it.
New. We just let Dan edit that out, right, because he has so much time at night right after the right after the show.
Edit. Because we're all about the post-production.
Yes, we are. Because we're a podcast, like everybody keeps telling us, you know. How come you can't get your sound quality like, you know, the other podcasts? Well, because we're not a freaking podcast, that's why.
Hey, you wrote a podcast catcher.
Right?
That wasn't for
the
show.
That doesn't mean that we're a podcast.
You know what I think the problem is, Link? You don't understand the question. That's
what it is. I'm confusing the question.
You're confused.
You're not asking the right question.
You're confused.
What's the question?
Good question.
This is just not the right one.
Oh.
Whatever it wasn't the right one.
Yeah, it's not the right question. I refuse to think about that because you're not asking me the right question. Anyway.
You know what, though? This whole Sun GPLN of Java, they had Stallman on there. Did you see the website with those little interview clips?
Yes.
No.
He was on there. Tim O'Reilly was on there. A bunch of other people, too.
Yes.
So what do you think about this, the Sun release in Java as open source?
I think it's great. Absolutely fantastic. I would love to see Sun also GPL Solaris so that we can take the best and greatest features of Solaris and incorporate them into Linux. But on the flip side, you know, yeah, it's open Solaris, but it's incompatible with the GPL. You know, the Linux people can't go in there and take, say, ZFS or you know, some of the other utilities and bring them into Linux. If they bring it over to the GPL, they will be able to do that.
I don't know. I tell you what, I have used Solaris before, and I'll stick with Linux. That's why I run Linux, in fact.
I prefer it, too, you know, but there are some things about it that are good. You have to give credit where it's due, you know.
But, yeah, I applaud I applaud Sun's effort, and I, you know, I like to see them releasing Java as open source, and then, you know, we can sort of solidify around one version instead of, you know, flipping back and forth between Microsoft and everything else for Java development. Hopefully they'll just take right off with this Sun stuff, and you know, that'll be good to go. Not that I do any coding in it, because I'm still Java illiterate. But at least now,
well, all those companies that run Java, they are now using a ton of free software, whether they like it or not.
Well, when is it going to actually be released under the GPL or converted to the GPL license? I mean, that doesn't automatically mean Java is GPL, like version 1.5. Is that GPL now, or is that still under their old license and the new version will be GPL?
I think the official cutover date, I think they said, is March, I think.
And that's going to be 1.6?
I think it's going to be for everything. It's going to be recursive going back.
Yeah.
I think they're going to have like a dual license kind of deal, you know, like how MySQL has it.
Right.
So if people have like commercial agreements with Sun, it'll still be under that, well, at the same time being released under GPL.
Cool.
Yeah, it's good stuff, man. It's good news.
Hotness. Link, you going to talk about the OSD?
OSD? Yeah, I am going to talk about the OSD, at least for a few minutes.
You got a minute.
Cool.
A
couple minutes, maybe. All right. Oh,
you're done. Sorry. On to the next topic.
Yeah, Neuros OSD. They sent me, you know, the Neuros guys are just fantastic, right? Joe Bourne, he's the man of the hour, I'm telling you. They sent me this device, just like they sent me the Recorder 2. I think it's the 2. To check out and give my opinion on. And let me first say that the OSD is a slick-looking thing, right? It has inputs for like damn near anything. You can do composite inputs for video and audio, and you can do S video in, and it's got, you know, places for you to plug in USB devices and memory cards and all kinds of crap, right? Really cool stuff. The problem with it is, right now, the software is still very beta, if it is even beta at this point in time. I noticed there are a lot of features that they want to try and incorporate in this, and I really think that they're gonna pull it off, but it's not there yet. Right now, with the software being in such a beta stage, what I experienced was the recording is real choppy. And I tried three or four different settings. It didn't really seem to matter. In fact, it didn't even seem to change based on the settings that I picked. The menu system is not really very intuitive. The USB recording, you know, recording to like a USB device, didn't work at all. I will say, however, though, that you can like pretty much hot plug devices in there. You can plug a USB pen drive or a USB hard drive or, you know, what have you, or a memory card or whatnot. As long as you're not on them, you can plug them and unplug them, and it seems to work pretty well, mount stuff up like it's supposed to. And you can browse in there, and you can play little movies on it and stuff like that, as long as they're in the right format. And that kind of seemed a little bit choppy, too. So, you know, it's horrible to give a bad review on such a cool device that I see a lot of a potential for, but like right now, if you're not interested in doing more development on it, I would stay away, unless you want to get into it now before you know, maybe the price will go up or something like that. If you want to get into it now and you know, just play with it and run your operating system and your software updates as they come along to check it out. That might be a great thing, because we don't know, you know, if this becomes the next best thing since sliced bread, maybe they're going to raise the price or something like that. But if you're looking for a full-featured solution right now and you don't want to play, stay away. Buy the Neuros Recorder 2. the MPEG recorder. That's the way to go right now. Unless you want to play with it, like I said, if you want to play with it, definitely grab the OSD and, you know, contribute if you can, because it's going to be a cool thing. Just not there yet.
This is just a development platform at this point, right?
It is, right. It's all open hardware, and it's all open software, and their developers are releasing stuff for all the time. In fact, yeah, the first thing that they tell you in the box in the installation instructions to do is when you get the thing to upgrade the firmware. Because they're assuming that, you know, there's going to be new firmware updates all the time, and pretty much there are. They're you know, moving right along with it. So, you know, I didn't go in this expecting it to be, you know, consumer ready, I guess, to begin with. And it's not. It's neat to play with. But I really think that it's gonna get much better, and it'll get much better, you know, right along.
Whoa, you finished?
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay.
Just stopped.
No, it's just a really good, neat little thing. And, you know, if you want to help contribute to something really cool like that, you know, by all means, jump into it right now. If you're waiting for a more polished product, you're going to have to wait a little while. That's all there is to it. But it is pretty cool, you know, no doubt about that.
All right. Hey, you know, people have been asking me about my job, and I was going to mention something about it today, but I don't know if I should. We have enough time?
Go ahead.
4 minutes, yeah.
All right. Well, I haven't really talked much about my job because there's not much to say. I do PHP development, and the backend servers are all running on Linux, and they were really gung-ho about open source. And, of course, in a company like that, the desktop is Windows XP and their tech support, which has been, entrenched for a long time, only wants to support Windows, or particularly Windows XP. Well, anyway, when I got there, they pretty much said, you know, you could use whatever you want on the system to do your job, as long as you get your job done, and understand that, you know, they only support Windows XP, they only support Outlook for email and Office, Microsoft Office. But, you know, so, you know, they were like, well, you can, if you want to use Firefox, go ahead. If you want to use Thunderbird, go ahead, which I did. And they're like, you know, we use Zend here. We'll set you up with Zend. So aside from Zend, all the other applications I was using were pretty much, you know, the same stuff I use on Linux. You know, for instant messaging, I was using Game, of course, Firefox, Thunderbird, and Cygwin for shell access, and then, okay, MySQL query browser, and all that. So they don't want us installing Linux on the systems. In fact, tech support even sent out an email saying that, you know, we're not going to allow Linux to be installed anymore. You know, if you haven't installed, let us know. We'll come and replace it with Windows XP for you, which, of course, was ridiculous. They recanted then a few days later, but they don't want us installing XP. Enough said. So after a while, I got to thinking to myself, why not just run VMware Player and see how, you know, stuff runs in there, and how I can, you know, if I could just get that run and see what that's like. And so I did. I, you know, got VMware Player and grabbed my Arch CD and did an install of Arch and VMware Player and started off with that, and things were working out pretty well. And what was interesting is when I first started there, I had 512 megabytes of RAM. A couple weeks later, they came by and upped me to a gig, and the weirdest thing happened was that my system actually performed a little more sluggish on a gig of RAM, which kind of threw me. You know, it was odd that it would be a little more sluggish. So I decided this week, I started looking around, I say, I have everything that I use under Linux under VMware. The only thing I don't have is Xen. So I fired up Arch. I was using that, and I said, well, you know, why don't I try Quanta out? Because I have never really given Quanta much of a trial or a second thought. So I fired Quanta up, and pretty much, now, I'm not a big Xen user. They basically dropped it in front of me and said, here, use this. And while it's nice, I know I don't use 90% of the features available in it. So switching over to Quanta was almost a no-brainer. It did everything I did in Xen. The only thing it doesn't seem to have is checking my syntax, or maybe it does. I just don't know how to enable it. It's got the bracket completion and code highlighting and everything, so it's been a pretty easy transition. And, you know, the last thing I got running today was Sound through VMware. And the damn thing runs under VMware Player, Arch Linux, running KDE, 1280 by 1024, running all the applications I run, runs a hell of a lot better than running those applications under Windows XP. So it was interesting. It's been a pretty interesting thing.
Now, but you know what the trick is now? The trick is now to actually install Linux on that computer and then install XP under VMware so that when the IT guys come by, you can just flip your VMware open with XP.
Yeah,
that'll make it more stable, too.
I could do that. You know what? I've been running KDE. KDE's been running great. We use Subversion over there. I started using, KDE's SVN client, which works pretty great. I use Subversion on the command line. That works great. I wanted to use Songbird on it, but for some reason Songbird can't grab the audio device. I don't know why. It's really weird, and I can't figure out a way to configure
under
it.
Under Arch, yeah.
No, I had no problem running Songbird on my Arch system at home. It works great. But
well,
over there,
no, I tried it on my Arch system here, and it doesn't work. I can't get it to grab the audio device.
That's odd. What desktop are you using?
KDE.
Now, see, maybe it's a KDE thing, because I tried disabling Arch, and I still had the same problem. But I run it under Arch, XFCE here. I have no problem running Songbird. So in place of Songbird, I decided to give Amarok a spin, and, you know, that's a pretty sweet application. I do like that. And you know what? I don't know where the hell the echo's coming from.
I don't hear an echo.
No, we don't hear it here, but if you listen to the stream, there's a little bit of one.
But where is that echo coming from?
I'm not sure why. To be honest with you, Dan, I don't really know right now.
All right.
It's your headphones echoing through your head into your microphone.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
So maybe it is a KDE thing.
Dan's hollow head is echoing back.
Yeah. And what's cool about, you know, what's nice about VMware is after I get Windows up and running, I just click on the VMware, and it fires up my session. It's, you know, it's kind of like it suspends it where you last left it, and you bring it up, and you're ready to go in, like, just a few seconds. You don't have to wait for it to boot. So while Windows is coming up, VMware's already up, and KDE's running and on Arch Linux perfectly fine. Some good stuff.
Now, you said you use Quanta. Have you tried Kate?
I've used Kate in the past. I wasn't, you know, if I was going to use Kate, I'd probably drop down to Bluefish or JEdit, because I wasn't too endeared to Kate. But, you know, Quanta, as a drop-in replacement for Xen, seemed to work pretty well for me. But, you know, maybe I need to give Kate a little more trial than I actually did before. Are you using Kate?
If I have to use something like that, I use Kate. Because it's a little bit lighter than Quanta is. But generally speaking, I do my PHP development because, you know, for those of you who don't know, my job is PHP development too. I do my PHP development in VI and use Firefox to browse, you know, to test it out. So, but if I, you know, occasionally I get in the mood to, like, use a GUI client kind of thing with some extra features, and I go for Kate at that point in time.
I'll have to give Kate a look.
You know, Quanta's a little bit heavy for me.
Quanta, 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 Quanta. Kwanzaa.
Quanta, 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 Quanta.
Holy moly, I guess I better knock us off of BinRev if we're not already knocked off.
Good night, BinRev.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, that's my spiel for this week. You guys have anything else? Frapper map shoutouts?
You know, Frapper, they changed it, the look of the site again. It looks like the count is gone now. So we have no idea how many people, you know, have been added since last week. I mean, I could look at the list, and I could see the names, and I have an idea how many. But the count that shows up on, that used to show up on top, is gone now, so.
They pretty much raped all the functionality out of there, huh?
Yeah, they got rid of all the good stuff. Well, anyway, let me mention some names that have been on there since last time. We've got, Mikey from Brussels, Philip Scott from Akron, Ohio, Eric from Geneva, Switzerland, Khan Pham from Maryland, USA, and Michael Hunt from St. Louis, Missouri.
St. Louis!
Where the hell do you even see people who just recently signed up? Are those a recent shout-out?
You go to view all pins?
No.
No, you go on the left-hand column, this says map pins. The bottom one says view all pins. It'll list the last people who joined.
Oh. Uh-huh. Huh. Bastards. Why did they take that away?
I have no idea. It's kind of annoying.
They knew Pat was using it.
A lot of people use it, actually.
Bastards.
Anyhow.
So are we going to play that song?
Yeah.
Yeah, play the song.
Dan, you got it?
Yeah, I do. I'm just waiting for somebody to introduce it.
Well, one of our listeners from Belgium, Bert Van Ketz, he mentioned that he knew this guitarist who's a session guy. He does instrumental stuff. He plays with a bunch of different people. He does all sorts of recording. This guy by the name of Neil Jones, he's from the UK. And he said we could use some of his tracks. He sent us one, and he's going to send us some more stuff to play.
What's his website?
His website is, it's a MySpace website, actually. It's hold on a sec, I'll tell you. Just give me a sec.
Actually, I think it's just his
name.
It's
www.myspace.com/ Neil Jones Guitar, one word.
Oh, okay.
So you can check out Neil Jones. He actually played with
really
Kim Wilde.
Yeah, really good stuff, too, yeah.
You remember her, Kim Wilde?
Yeah.
She's actually still around, and he plays with her. He plays with a whole bunch of different people. But he does a lot of session work, Neil, and he plays, he does some instrumental stuff, soundtracking stuff, and it's pretty good. He's a good guitar player. And, he said we can use this stuff anytime we want, so that's pretty damn cool. The name of the track is Extreme 101.
Play us out, Dan.
All right, here we go.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. Good night.
shut up. Just shut up.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Mm, yeah, with my tongue brush. Over.
It's over.